Welcome to this deep dive, fellow practitioners. Today we are studying a text that really, well, it asks us to pack our bags for a profound existential journey. But there is a catch.
Right. A pretty massive catch, actually.
Exactly. Because the sutra we're unpacking today tells us that while the journey of life, death, and rebirth is absolutely real, the traveler, meaning you, the core identity you believe yourself to be, is a complete illusion.
Yeah, which is, I mean, for anyone who has spent time on the meditation cushion, this is the ultimate paradox of the practice.
It really is. We are told, you know, over and over that there is no immutable self. We're taught the doctrine of an Atman or no self. We're taught that all phenomena are fundamentally empty. And yet, at the exact same time, the Buddha emphatically taught the reality of karma.
Right. The law of cause and effect.
Yeah. He taught that our actions carry over from one life to the next. So the question is, if there is no soul, if there's no permanent self, what exactly is carrying the luggage? I mean, how does a karmic action from this life find its way into the next if the traveler doesn't even exist?
It is. It's probably the most persistent, challenging question in the entire Buddhist philosophical tradition. It's the very edge where our ordinary conceptual mind just starts to fray, because we desperately want our experiences to belong to an experiencer.
Totally. We need a me in the center of it all.
Right. We assume a continuous self because it's the bedrock of our waking lives. But to step into the Dharma is to, you know, step into a landscape that dismantles that assumption piece by piece. So to explore how karma functions without a soul, we are going to immerse ourselves in a truly remarkable sacred source text today. We are looking at the Noble Mahayana Sutra Transmigration Through Existences.
Yes, and for those of you studying along with us, in the Tibetan tradition, this is known as the Phags Pasri Pafo Baziz Baba Thig Pachin Toi the Yamdo. It is a canonical text. Specifically, it's 226 of the Deje Kangur, which is the foundational collection of the translated words of the Buddha in the Tibetan Buddhist canon.
A really vital collection.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And I want to emphasize that our mission in this study session isn't just academic. We are looking at this text because it is a, well, it's a masterclass in the mechanics of reality. It addresses the practitioner's daily life. And we'll be working from a meticulous English translation prepared by the Kitamuka Translation Group under the auspices of the 84,000 Project.
And, you know, the lineage of this text is something we really should pause to appreciate before we dive into the philosophy. We are participating in a stream of Dharma transmission that has flowed continuously for over a millennium.
It's staggering to think about.
It is. The original translation into Tibetan occurred during the Great Imperial Translation period. So we're talking about the 8th or 9th century of the Common Era. And this was not a casual undertaking. It was a rigorous, highly collaborative effort of the highest spiritual and scholarly order.
Right. They didn't have the internet. They were crossing mountains.
Exactly. It involved the revered Indian preceptors, Jina Mitra and Dhanashila, who traveled across the Himalayas, working intimately with the great Tibetan chief editor and translator, Bande Yeshe Day. Their work was so authoritative that this exact sutra is listed in the earliest Tibetan imperial catalogs, like the Dengkarma and the Fengthangma.
Wow.
Yeah, so when we read these words today, we're relying on a linguistic and spiritual bridge built by masters who dedicated their lives to ensuring these precise meanings were not lost. And the bamboo grove, you know, it carries such a resonant atmosphere in the sutra. It was one of the very first pieces of land donated to the Buddhist Sukha, and it was donated by King Bimbisara himself. It was a place of deep refuge, a quiet sanctuary away from the noise of the city, where the earliest monastic community really formed its roots.
And the text paints this majestic scene. The Buddha isn't alone in this sanctuary. He is surrounded by a massive assembly, a great monastic saiga of 1,250 monks, alongside this multitude of bodhisattvas. And the sutra tells us he is expounding a conduct that is virtuous in the beginning, virtuous in the middle, and virtuous in the end.
That's such a beautiful phrase.
I have always loved that specific phrase. I mean, it suggests a teaching that is completely whole, you know, unblemished from its opening premise all the way to its final conclusion.
Yes. It signifies a teaching that doesn't rely on blind faith at the start, only to fall apart under logical scrutiny at the end. It is a path that withstands the most rigorous investigation. And into this setting arrives the patron of the bamboo grove himself, King Surya Bimbisara of Magadha.
The king makes his entrance.
He does. He is the ruler of a vast realm, arriving with all the pomp and power of his station from Rajagaha. But his behavior upon entering the grove is vital to note here. This man, who commands armies and immense wealth, approaches the Blessed One, bows his head to the Buddha's feet, circumambulates him 3 times as a sign of supreme reverence, and then takes his seat to one side.
It really sets the tone for the entire text, doesn't it? Worldly power submitting to ultimate spiritual wisdom. And King Bimbisara, he does not waste the Buddha's time. He doesn't ask about statecraft or mundane affairs. He asks a question that reveals a mind grappling with the absolute deepest implications of the Dharma.
He cuts right to the heart of it.
He really does. Let me read his inquiry directly from the text, because the phrasing is dense and requires our full attention. So the king asks, "Blessed one, how does an action, performed and accumulated, having ceased and ceased for a long while, manifest in the mind when the moment of death is imminent? Since all formations are empty, how are actions not lost?"
Let's just sit with that question for a moment.
That's heavy.
It is tightly constructed and honestly philosophically devastating. The king has identified the precise fault line between 2 massive pillars of the Buddha's teaching. On one side, you have the relentless, exact law of moral cause and effect karma. On the other side, you have the doctrine that all phenomena are empty and fleeting. Bimbisara is essentially asking, how can both of these things be true at the same time?
I want to break this down because for a practitioner listening, the terminology can be intimidating. The king mentions formations and emptiness. For a practitioner trying to fully grasp the weight of this inquiry, we need to be crystal clear on what these words mean in this context. What exactly is a formation?
Right. So in Sanskrit, the word is saiskara, and in Tibetan, it's dubaid. A formation is, it's anything that is compounded. Anything that is put together by causes and conditions is a formation.
Like physical things.
Yes. Your physical body is a formation of bones, blood, and tissue. A mountain is a formation of rock and tectonic pressure. But crucially, your thoughts are also formations. And an action, a karmic deed is a formation. It is an event put together by intention, effort, and completion. And the defining characteristic of any formation is that because it is put together, it must inevitably fall apart. It is inherently impermanent.
Okay, so if everything put together eventually falls apart, that leads us directly to emptiness.
Mm.
But emptiness, Shunyata, it doesn't mean a black hole or a dark void, does it?
Not at all. That is probably the most common misunderstanding. Emptiness means that because all these formations are dependently originated, because they rely entirely on external causes and conditions to exist, they are empty of any independent, permanent, inherent essence.
They lack a solid core.
Exactly. They exist dynamically, like a rainbow. A rainbow appears vividly, you can see its colors, but if you try to grab it, there is nothing there. It only exists as a temporary conjunction of light, water droplets, and the observer's eye. All formations are like that rainbow.
I want to offer an analogy here to highlight just how impossible the king's question seems if we really take emptiness seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine an action. A karmic deed is like a footprint you leave on a sandy beach. You step, and the imprint is made. Bimbisara is basically saying, "Blessed one, if the footprint was made a long time ago and the tide has come in and completely washed away, meaning the action has fully ceased. And furthermore, if the teachings on emptiness tell us that ultimately there is no inherent foot and there is no inherent beach, how on earth does that vanished footprint shape the trajectory of our next life? Where is the imprint stored if everything is fleeting and empty?"
That analogy captures the tension beautifully. Because early Buddhist philosophy was incredibly strict about the momentariness of actions. An action doesn't have a lingering physical substance.
Mm-hmm.
You perform a deed through body, speech, or mind, and the very moment that deed is completed, it ceases. It exhausts its moment of existence and is just gone.
So it doesn't like hover over me like a dark karmic cloud or follow me around like a golden halo.
Precisely. It doesn't physically linger in the atmosphere. So Bimbisara is pointing out a massive logistical problem. If the action ceases immediately and if there is no permanent soul or, you know, metaphysical backpack to store all these good and bad deeds over a lifetime, where do they go? How can a kind word spoken or a harm committed decades ago suddenly ripen at the exact moment of death to steer your consciousness into a new realm?
It feels like cause and effect are operating across an impossible gap of empty space.
Yeah.
Bimbisara is worried that if actions cease and are empty, karma should just disappear into the void. It's a terrifying thought for a practitioner, actually. It implies that maybe our actions don't matter.
Which is why the Buddha's response is so crucial here. If he answers this poorly, the entire ethical foundation of the Dharma collapses. But the Buddha, being the ultimate pedagogue, does not respond with a dense, impenetrable metaphysical treatise. He grounds his answer in an intensely relatable human experience. He uses a dream.
Let's read the Buddha's response. He says to the king, "Great king, it is like this. To give an analogy, a man has dreamed that he is cavorted with the most beautiful woman in the land, and then upon waking, he keeps recollecting that most beautiful woman in the land. And then the Buddha asked the king, does that most beautiful woman in the land from the dream exist? And of course, King Bimbisara replies, no, blessed one, she does not.
The Buddha is carefully establishing a baseline of reality here. He is taking an experience we have all had, waking up from a vivid dream. The dream object, no matter how emotionally compelling it was, has absolutely no substantial existence in the waking world. It is a pure fabrication of the sleeping mind.
The Buddha then follows up with a critical question. He asks, in that case, is that person who has become fixated on the most beautiful woman in the land wise in nature? And the king replies, no, blessed one, why is that? Because the most beautiful woman in the land from the dream is utterly non-existent and cannot be observed. As there is no way he can cavort with her, that man is bound to be miserable and exhausted.
Notice the profound psychological insight here. The woman does not exist. The event of the dream has completely ceased. It evaporated the moment the man opened his eyes. And yet, and this is the key to the entire sutrafist, the effect of this non-existent ceased phenomenon is undeniably real in the waking world.
Right. His feelings are real.
Exactly. The man's passion is real. His fixation is real. His misery and his exhaustion are tangible consequences stemming from something that has absolutely no inherent reality and resides entirely in the past.
The illusion breaks down, but the karma of the illusion continues. The dreamer wakes up, but the emotional momentum carries forward, ruining his waking day. The Buddha explicitly connects this psychological mechanism to the cosmic mechanics of karma. He explains that childish, unlearned beings, which is to say, you know, all of us who haven't realized the ultimate nature of reality, we go through our waking lives exactly like that foolish dreamer. We see pleasant forms with our eyes, we become fixated, we become enamored, and from that enamorment, we commit actions conditioned by passion, anger, and ignorance.
And the commentaries elaborate deeply on this conditioning process. They note there are three types of conditioning of the body, four of speech, and three of the mind. This covers the entire spectrum of human karmic activity. Every single action we take that generates karma is rooted in a fundamental misapprehension of reality. We treat the fleeting, empty forms of waking life exactly as the foolish man treats the phantom woman in his dream.
We think they're solid.
Right. We think these forms are real, solid, permanent sources of satisfaction or threat.
But then the Buddha makes a radical statement that circles right back to the king's initial anxiety about actions disappearing. The Buddha confirms the king's premise. He says that these actions, having been conditioned and performed, do in fact cease. They do not go into a cosmic storage locker. The Buddha states explicitly, having ceased, an action does not remain anywhere in the east or in the south, in the west or in the north.
Oh.
It does not remain above, below, or in the intermediate directions.
This is the Buddhist doctrine of impermanence applied without mercy. The action is gone, utterly gone. Just like the dream woman upon waking, you cannot point to anywhere in the physical or metaphysical universe and say, ah, there is where my past karma is currently sitting, waiting for me.
But I have to push back here. I'm genuinely struggling with this as we discuss it. If the action is completely gone, if it's stored nowhere in the 10 directions, what exactly is happening at the moment of death? Let's say I commit a terrible crime when I am 20 and I live a long life and die when I am 80. That criminal action has been gone physically and temporally for 60 years. If there is no soul to carry the stain of that guilt and the action itself has vanished completely from the universe, why should I care if the quote-unquote next consciousness suffers the karmic result? It feels like the ultimate loophole. It feels like Bimbisara's fear is justified, cause and effect are broken.
That sense of a loophole, or even a sense of nihilistic dread, is exactly what Bimbisara was wrestling with. And it is why the Buddha transitions from the analogy into a precise moment-to-moment breakdown of the mechanics of dying and rebirth. He is about to show how the echo survives the silence without needing a soul to carry it.
Walk us through it. What happens in that final breath? The text says the moment of death approaches and the karma that propelled the current life is finally exhausted. What occurs in the mind stream?
The sutra states that as the final consciousness of this life ceases, the past karma, that action from long ago, suddenly manifests in the mind. How does it manifest? It arises exactly like the memory of the dream woman appearing to the waking man. The physical action itself isn't there, but its causal potential, its psychological imprint, arises forcefully in the final moment of awareness.
So the past action serves as a condition for the present mind, even though the action itself is dead and gone. It's like, well, it's like looking up at the night sky and seeing the light of a star that actually burned out millions of years ago.
That's a beautiful way to think of it.
The star is gone. It ceased a long time ago.
Yeah.
But the light it emitted is interacting with your optic nerve right now.
That is an excellent way to visualize it. The Sautrantika school of Buddhist philosophy, which was highly influential in interpreting these mechanics, they described this process using the metaphor of seeds, or bija in Sanskrit. Think about how an actual seed works. You plant an apple seed in the ground. The seed itself doesn't survive. It decomposes. It ceases to be a seed.
Right, it rots away.
Exactly. But before it ceases, it imparts a specific germinal potential to the soil and the sprout. The consciousness evolves moment by moment, like a flowing stream carrying this potentiality. The action ceased decades ago, but it planted a seed in the continuum of consciousness. When the precise conditions are met specifically, the dissolution of the body at the moment of death, that seed sprouts. The past karma manifests.
And the sutra details what happens in the very next microsecond. Immediately after that final consciousness ceases, the first consciousness belonging to the next life arises. The text lists the possible realms of rebirth that this consciousness might awaken into among the gods, humans, asuras, hell beings, animals, or pretas, which are the hungry ghosts.
Notice the seamless, unbroken nature of the transition. The cessation of the final consciousness of this life is the primary condition for the arising of the first consciousness of the next life. It is colored entirely by the karmic seed that just manifested.
There's a fascinating scholarly detail here that we need to highlight for our fellow practitioners. In many Tibetan traditions, there is a heavy emphasis on the bardo, the intermediate state between death and rebirth, which is often described as lasting up to 49 days. But as I read this specific sutra, it doesn't seem to implicate an intermediate state at all.
You are absolutely correct, and it's a crucial observation for understanding the historical strata of Buddhist texts. The language of this sutra implies instantaneous causality. The Buddha says, immediately after that first consciousness ceases, there arises the mind stream concordant with one's fortune.
Instantaneous.
Right. The early Theravadin schools and several other early Buddhist sects fiercely refuted the idea of an intermediary state. For them, and seemingly for the narrative presented in the sutra, the link between the last moment of consciousness here and the first moment of consciousness there is immediate. It is unbroken by any liminal waiting period. It highlights the sheer, uninterrupted, forceful momentum of karmic cause and effect.
And then the Buddha delivers what feels like the ultimate earth-shattering revelation of this entire section. He states, "Great King, no phenomenon whatsoever transmigrates from this world to another world, yet there are the manifestations of death and birth."
Let's pause and really let that sink in. No phenomenon whatsoever transmigrates. In the stillness of our own practice, this is what we are trying to realize. There is no soul crossing a cosmic river. There is no subtle glowing essence flying out of one body and into a womb. There is just the cessation of one moment causing the arising of the next.
The image that comes to mind is a line of falling dominoes. When one domino knocks over the next, no actual thing, no physical substance or wood or paint transfers from the first tile to the second. What transfers is momentum. Causal energy?
Yes, the energy passes through.
Right, the first domino falls and stays exactly where it is. It ceases its upright existence. But its falling is the precise condition that causes the next one to fall. Birth and death are just the manifestations of this karmic momentum passing through the medium of consciousness.
The domino analogy perfectly illustrates dependent origination. Now, because we are committed to a true deep dive into this text, we must embark on a massive historical detour regarding this exact line, because the phrase, "no phenomenon whatsoever transmigrates," was the epicenter of an explosive philosophical war within early Buddhism.
Yes, the Pudgalavadin controversy. When I was researching the translation history of this text, this absolutely blew my mind. So the Tibetan version we are studying, the newly discovered Sanskrit manuscript found in the Potala Palace in Tibet, and almost all the Chinese translations unanimously agree on this radical phrasing, "nothing transmigrates." But there is a glaring anomaly in the historical record.
There is indeed. In the 6th century, a highly influential Chinese translator named Boturuchi produced a version of this text, which is cataloged today as Taishu 575. And in his specific translation, the line reads, "There is one phenomenon that transmigrates from this life into the future life."
That is a staggering departure. No phenomenon transmigrates versus "there is one phenomenon that transmigrates." That completely flips the entire philosophical meaning of the sutra. Why would a translator make such a massive alteration?
To understand why, we have to understand the terror that the doctrine of no self induced in some early Buddhist communities. Scholars like N. Iyaswamy Sastry have deeply analyzed this anomaly, and they suggest it echoes the debates surrounding the Pudgalavadins.
Who were they, exactly?
The Pudgalavadins were a collection of early Buddhist schools, most notably the Vatsiputriya and Samatiya sects. And they were profoundly uncomfortable with the idea of a completely empty mind stream.
Because it brings us back to my earlier struggle. If there is literally zero me that carries over, why am I morally responsible for my actions? It feels like the person who commits the crime and the person who suffers the karmic punishment in the next life are two completely different entities.
Exactly. The Pudgalavadins felt that the orthodox teaching of momentariness destroyed moral responsibility. They felt that if consciousness is just a series of flashing moments, there is no place to store karma and no one to experience the results. So they proposed a controversial solution. They claimed that while there is no permanent soul or Atman in the Hindu sense, there is an undefinable person, a Pudgala.
It sounds like they were basically trying to sneak the concept of a soul through the back door. They couldn't call it a self without violating the Buddha's core teaching, so they rebranded it as an undefinable person.
That is exactly how the mainstream Buddhist schools viewed it. The Pudgalavadins used the analogy of fire and fuel. They said, the Pudgala, the person, is like fire, and the aggregates, the body and mind, are like fuel. The fire is not the same as the fuel, but it cannot exist independently of it. They argued this Pudgala is what transmigrates. It is the one phenomenon that carries the karmic baggage.
But the consensus of this sutra, as preserved in the pristine Tibetan and Sanskrit manuscripts, firmly slams that back door shut. It aligns perfectly with the orthodox view. There is no continuous entity, no Pudgala traveling across the void of death. There is only the domino effect.
And this brings us to a critical pivot in the text. Having established the mechanics of how karma works without a transmigrating self, the Buddha must now protect the king from falling into a new trap. He moves the discussion from the mechanics of cause and effect into the profound, dizzying perspective of radical emptiness.
Right, because our minds are so tricky. Even if we accept the domino analogy, okay, no soul, no Pudgala, but we might say, well, consciousness exists, the karmic seed exists, birth exists. We just take the heavy solidity, the grasping that we use to assign to ourselves, and we attach it to these Buddhist concepts instead.
Precisely. We turn karma into a sneaky, permanent replacement for the soul. We treat the mind stream as a subtle, eternal substance. We make the teachings solid. So the Buddha employs the logic of the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. He tells the king, great king, the final consciousness is empty of final consciousness. Transmigration after death is empty of transmigration after death. Action is empty of action. The first consciousness is empty of the first consciousness. And birth is empty of birth, yet actions manifest without being lost.
I want to focus on that phrasing. The final consciousness is empty of final consciousness. It sounds almost like a riddle. How can a thing be empty of itself? Let me share an analogy that helped me process this.
Please do.
Have you ever held an apple up to a mirror? If you look at the reflection of the apple, it functions perfectly as an image. It shows the red skin, the stem, the shape. If you move the physical apple, the reflection moves instantly. The reflection obeys the laws of optics impeccably. But if you investigate the mirror, is the reflection full of appleness? No. It is entirely empty of being an apple. There's no juice, no seeds, no weight, no nutritional value. The reflection is entirely dependent on the glass, the light, and the object. It is empty of reflection, yet the image manifests without being lost.
That is a phenomenal way to understand the Prajnaparamita approach. The process of karma, the transition from death to birth, functions impeccably. The moral laws of cause and effect are as rigorous and unbreakable as the laws of optics. But if you search for the essential independent reality of birth, death, or karma, you will find nothing. You will find no juice, no solid core. You will find only dependent conditions. They are as ungraspable as the woman in the dream or the apple in the mirror. They function, but they do not possess independent reality.
This realization that the machinery of reality is itself empty transitions the sutra into its final, most celebrated section. The text moves away from the narrative prose, away from the conversation between the Buddha and King Bimbisara, and shifts into seven dense poetic verses. And as we transition, it's crucial to note that these verses shift the focus entirely. The word transmigration isn't mentioned again. We are no longer talking about rebirth. We are entering a profound deconstruction of language and reality itself.
From a textual and historical perspective, these seven verses are massively influential across the Buddhist world. They parallel treatises attributed to the great second century Indian philosopher Nagarjuna, such as the Bhavasakliyanteshtra. you will find these verses heavily quoted across later Madhyamaka and Yogacara commentaries. They serve as a condensed scriptural authority for how Buddhists understand the relationship between language, conceptual thought, and ultimate truth.
But this creates a massive cognitive dissonance for the practitioner. If everything is empty, including my karma, including my consciousness, what is this reality I'm interacting with right now? What are these words we are speaking? The Buddha anticipates this confusion. Let's explore the first three verses. The Buddha says, all of these are mere names. They abide only as notions. Set apart from their verbal designations, what is designated does not exist. By whatever names any phenomena are designated, they do not exist therein. This is the very nature of phenomena. The nature of name is empty of name. A name does not exist as a name. All nameless phenomena have been designated by name. These three verses encapsulate what philosophers call the Buddhist nominalist position. When we look at the world, our ordinary, unawakened mind sees a world of separate, discrete things, a tree, a car, a person, a thought. We believe these things have substantial existence, which in Sanskrit is called dravyasat. But the sutra is pointing out that this separation is an illusion created by language. Things exist only nominally, prajaptisat. They exist as designated labels. The classic Buddhist analogy for this is the chariot, right? From the debates of King Milinda, we use the label chariot. But if you take away the wheels, the axle, the yoke, the wooden frame, where is the chariotness? It doesn't exist inside the parts, and it doesn't exist outside the parts.
Exactly. Chariot is just a useful verbal designation we apply to a constantly shifting collection of parts. And what the Buddha is saying here is that everything is like the chariot. If you peel away the label, the verbal designation, the phenomenon doesn't exist inside the name. As the verse says, set apart from their verbal designations, what is designated does not exist.
And because we forget this, because we confuse the label for reality, we suffer. We grasp at things. We grasp at our careers, our relationships, our bodies, our very identities, as if they were solid, permanent entities, when in fact they are just temporary assemblages of causes and conditions that we have slapped a name onto. The sutra says, all nameless phenomena have been designated by name. Reality in its raw, unfiltered state is nameless. It is a fluid, interdependent, vibrating continuum. It is our conceptual mind that slices it up into manageable pieces and names them.
But the Buddha knows that the intellect is a slippery thing. He knows that a clever practitioner might listen to these first three verses and say, ah, I understand. Everything is just a conceptual label. Therefore, emptiness is the ultimate reality. I will detach from all forms and just meditate on the pure void of emptiness.
Which leads to the disease of nihilism.
Yes, what the texts call emptiness sickness. Clinging to emptiness as if it were a new, solid reality. To prevent this, the Buddha delivers verse 4, which is absolutely mind-bending. The verse reads, these phenomena do not exist. They originate from conceptual thought. The conceptual thought that conceptualizes them as empty also does not exist.
Let's sit with that third line. The conceptual thought that conceptualizes them as empty also does not exist. You cannot even cling to the concept of emptiness. It leaves the mind with nowhere to land. It feels like the Buddha has just pulled the final rug out from under us.
This is the genius of the middle way, the Madhyamaka approach pioneered by Nagarjuna. The greatest trap in spiritual practice is to deconstruct all your worldly attachments, realize everything is empty, and then turn emptiness into a new sacred object of attachment.
You just swap one attachment for another.
Exactly. The Buddha is sweeping away the medicine along with the disease. The realization of emptiness is itself a concept. It is a tool. The Buddha famously compared the Dharma to a raft used to cross a rushing river. Once you reach the other shore, you don't pick up the heavy wooden raft and carry it on your back for the rest of your journey. You let it go. The thought of emptiness is just another thought, and it, too, lacks inherent existence.
But practically speaking, this is where I find myself getting stuck. If emptiness itself is a concept, and if everything is just a nameless flow of phenomena, how do I live in the world? If I'm walking down the street and a chariot is speeding toward me, do I just stand there contemplating the emptiness of the chariot? Do I say, ah, the chariot is merely a verbal designation and let myself get run over?
That is the crucial question, and it is why the sutra concludes with the final three verses. To survive and practice in the world without falling into either the extreme of eternalism, believing things are solid, or the extreme of nihilism, believing nothing matters, we must understand the hierarchy of truth. This brings us to the two truths. Relative truth and ultimate truth.
Let's look at verse 5, which establishes the relative truth. The Buddha says, the eye sees form, is said by one who observes correctly. To the world with its perverse arrogance, this was taught as the relative truth. So Here, the sutra is reassuring us. On a conventional, everyday level, it's perfectly correct to say, I see a tree, or the chariot is coming. It's not a lie. It is the relative truth taught to help beings function in the world.
Yes, Buddhism does not deny conventional reality. On the level of relative truth, Savatisachakarma operates. Eyes see forms. Actions have consequences. If you touch a hot stove, you will burn your hand. The relative truth must be respected. To ignore it is what the verse calls perverse arrogance.
But then we move to verse 6, where we look under the hood of conventional reality to find the ultimate truth. The text says, well, the guide has made known that seeing comes from a conjunction the wise speak of as the grounds for designating ultimate truth.
When we say the eye sees form in relative truth, we assume a solid subject, the eye or the eye, and a solid object, the form. We assume a fixed relationship. But the ultimate truth, Paramartha Satya, reveals that seeing is actually a conjunction. It is dependently originated. For seeing to occur, you need an unimpaired sense organ, you need a visible object, you need light, and you need the arising of visual consciousness. If any one of those conditions is missing, seeing ceases. Therefore, there is no independent seer. There is no little person sitting inside your head looking out through your eyes. There is only a momentary, fragile coming together of causes and conditions.
The solid subject and object dissolve into a web of dynamic relationship. That makes logical sense. We have the relative truth to navigate the street, and the ultimate truth to understand the nature of the street. But the sutra doesn't stop there. It gives us verse 7, which serves as the climax of the entire teaching. The eye does not see form, and the mind does not know phenomena. That is the supreme truth. The world does not fathom it. The mind does not know phenomena. When I read that line, I felt a sense of vertigo. What does it mean to call this the supreme truth?
This is where the teaching demands everything of us. It is vital to understand that the sutra is not creating a third truth. It is not adding another metaphysical category to our filing cabinet. It is pointing out that our conceptual notions of relative truth and ultimate truth are themselves just concepts. They are dualistic labels we use to organize our philosophy.
They are just more names, more rafts.
Exactly. When the text says the eye does not see form and the mind does not know phenomena, it means that at the level of direct, unmediated, awakened realization, the supreme truth, the very mechanisms of conceptual knowing break down. The ordinary mind operates by dividing reality into a knower and a known. It requires distance. But in the ultimate non-dual nature of reality, there is no separation between the observer and the observed. Therefore, the conceptual mind cannot know it. To truly understand reality, we must transcend dualistic labels altogether. The intellect must surrender to direct, non-conceptual experience. That is why the verse says the world does not fathom it, because the ordinary world operates entirely within the strict bounds of concept, language, and separation.
It is a breathtaking journey. We started with a king asking a highly logical, almost mechanistic question about how a past action triggers a future birth across the gap of death. And through the Buddha's guidance, we have arrived at the total dissolution of conceptual knowing itself. And as we reach the conclusion of this study session, it is beautiful to see how the sutra itself ends. It does not end in confusion or despair. It ends in profound joy. The text tells us, the Blessed One having spoken, King Srejabimbisara of Magadha, the Bodhisattvas and monks, and the world with its gods, humans, asuras, and Gandharvas, rejoiced and praised the words of the Blessed One.
That rejoicing is a crucial element of the text. It reminds us that these teachings, while intellectually rigorous, challenging, and sometimes deeply disorienting, are not meant to induce nihilism. They are meant to liberate. Realizing that the self is empty, realizing that the conceptual mind cannot grasp reality, is not a loss. It is the dropping of a tremendous, exhausting burden. It is the joy of profound release from the anxiety of maintaining a false identity.
To synthesize the core insights we've explored today, karma operates impeccably as an unbroken stream of cause and effect. It survives death, not because a soul carries it like luggage, but because the final consciousness of one life acts as the immediate condition for the first consciousness of the next. It is colored by past actions that manifest like the powerful emotional memories of a dream. Yet this entire flawless mechanism is absolutely empty of any permanent self, soul, or transmigrating entity. Reality, ultimately, is a dazzling, nameless display of empty, dependent phenomena. For a practitioner sitting on the cushion right now, how do we integrate this? How do we live gracefully with this paradox?
Understanding this text allows a practitioner to hold two seemingly contradictory postures at exactly the same time without friction. On one hand, you take your ethical conduct incredibly seriously because actions do ripen. Just as the dream creates real waking misery, your actions today condition your mind stream tomorrow and into your next life. You cannot escape the relative truth of cause and effect. But simultaneously, as you walk through your day, you learn to let go of the tight, anxious grasping at yourself. You realize that both the actor and the action are fundamentally empty. You don't have to carry the heavy burden of a fixed identity. You can engage with the world compassionately, ethically, and fully, but you do so lightly. You know it is all a reflection in the mirror, a beautiful, dependently originated display.
Taking karma seriously, but taking oneself lightly. That is a beautiful, stabilizing way to walk the path. As we close this Dharma teaching today, I want to leave you, the practitioner, with a final provocative thought. Think back to the image we started with, the instinctual comfort of the traveler packing their bags for a journey. We spend so much of our daily lives anxious about the future. We worry about our next steps, our careers, our relationships, and ultimately our next life. But if the mind that worries about the future is just as empty, just as dependently originated as the future it worries about, and if, as the sutra says, the mind does not know phenomena, at the supreme level of truth, what happens to our daily fears? What happens to our deepest anxieties about who we are and where we are going if we simply stop naming them? What remains when the traveler finally puts down the heavy baggage of their own name? Sit with that. Thank you for joining us in the depths today.